You're listening to Alumni Aloud, a new podcast by Graduate Center students for Graduate Center students. In each episode, we talk with a GC graduate about their career and the advice they would give current students. This series is sponsored by the Office of Career Planning and Professional Development at the Graduate Center. Interviewed Susan for this episode. I'm a PhD candidate in educational psychology at the Grad Center, and I work in the Office of Career Planning and Professional Development. Recently, I was in DC and met with one of our graduates from the biology PhD program. Susan Tsang is a AAAS policy fellow at U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Susan will get into more detail, but I wanted to sort out that within the U.S. Department of Interior, there is the Fish and Wildlife Service. Within that agency, Susan is in the Division of Management Authority, which, according to their website, implements domestic laws and international treaties to promote long-term conservation of global fish and wildlife resources. And she specifically works within the Counter Wildlife Trafficking Strategies and Partnerships branch. I also wanted to apologize for the background noise in this interview. It was the most convenient meeting place for both of us while I was briefly in DC. But if you hang in there, I promise you'll get some great information from Susan's experience. You've explained it to me prior to this, so I know how to approach this, but you kind of hold this joint position where you're a fellowship from AAAS, which you applied to AAAS. You got this fellowship, and they place you in a government agency. So tell us about your placement process, what you did coming out of graduate school, and then we'll get into the details of the job that you actually do.
So for background, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS, they have a science and technology policy fellowship where they bring in people with STEM PhDs or graduate degrees if you're in engineering into the government by placing you to a place that is appropriate for your skills and your expertise. And the whole point is that they're bringing in subject matter experts into these positions that can help you transition more into policy work because most people are showing an interest in that. They're moving into AAAS. So there are four different tracks. There is the Health and Human Services track, the Diplomacy track, the Big Data track, and the track that I'm on is the Energy, Environment, Agriculture track. And so it's basically where biologists usually end up if they're more on the ecology side. And my particular placement is at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm in International Affairs. So we're all down in headquarters in Northern Virginia. And I'm in the Division of Management Authority within the Counter Wildlife Trafficking Strategies and Partnerships branch. So it's a small group, but we do a lot of collaborations, as the name suggests. So I work very closely with people in the Department of State. So we work specifically with the INL, which is the International Bureau for Narcotics and Law Enforcement. And they fund Fish and Wildlife to implement projects in order to try to counter wildlife trafficking in Southeast Asia. So my particular title is the program manager of the INL Fish and Wildlife Interagency Agreement on Counter Wildlife Trafficking in Southeast Asia. And then the placement process itself. So you apply for the AAAS in November, and then you hang out and wait, as always. And then eventually they email you and they say, hey, you're a semifinalist in whatever track you apply to. You can apply to up to two. You can get responses from both that say you're a semifinalist. And they give you 10 days to write a policy brief. They give you a piece of paper that says these are the topics. Choose one that you're not an expert on. And they know because you submitted the application that said these things you are an expert on. So you can't lie about that and change it. They tricked you. And you write this one pager. And then in a couple weeks after they've gotten the policy brief, you have a WebEx interview where there's a panel of AAAS staff and also folks who are alum. And they will get a 5-minute presentation from you on the policy brief, ask you questions about the policy brief after that, then ask about yourself, your experience, your background, why you want to apply for the fellowship now. And then they give you a chance, like 5 minutes, to ask them questions. So it's a very, very short interview. And then once that's done, there's a couple more weeks, and then they'll, you know, if you get through, they'll say, hey, you're a finalist for this track, and we're inviting you down in April to come and get placed with the agencies. So you're a finalist, it basically means AAAS already accepted you, and now it's just trying to find the agency match. It's kind of like med school. right? So then you go to all these different places and you have interviews with all of them. You talk about whatever the position is. They give you a position description.
Can you name some of the agencies that?
Yeah, so I interviewed specifically at U.S. Fish and Wildlife, NASA, and at three different offices at the National Science Foundation. But there were also other agencies that were offering it, such as the EPA. In previous years, they've had NOAA offer some positions. In my year, they didn't. They have the National Institutes for Science and Technology, which I didn't know was even a thing. They have positions at NIH. They have positions at different parts of Department of State, Department of Energy. They have some folks at USGS sometimes, but not a lot. It's because it's very much actually dependent on the agency having money. Because what happens is the agency will front the money for the fellow, basically. And then the fellows will have positions to apply to. Ours is more like a match process, like med school. Because you interview with everybody, then you give AAAS your top list, and they give their top list also of their preferred candidates. And AAAS tries to make the best matches. And if you don't get your top choices, they will try to help you find a good match somewhere else, basically. So they will try to help you if something doesn't work out. And they have some time to do that because they make the offers usually in June officially. And so you sign the paperwork and you wait until you start in September. And because I knew that it would take a long time to get my background check done, because I was born in another country, I'm a naturalized citizen. Okay. And on top of that, I did a lot of international work as a graduate student, so I have to put all of the...
So you look kind of...
I look kind of shady.
Busy.
And I have to put all the people I know in the, you know, foreign friends and other stuff, so...
Wow.
There's like a long background check,
yeah.
So I started a little bit early, trying to get my badge early. In the government, you need a badge to get on your computer even, so you can't really do anything that's like sensitive information. It's not classified, it's just sensitive information, so you need your computer. And I spent maybe the first 2 or 3 weeks using my regular computer. You have to pass through a certain training that allows you to do that even, but I had to do some work, so we just made me take the training and while I waited for my card. But once you're in, and you have a 2-week orientation with AAAS where they give an overview of the government. So if you're not actually aware of how the government works, we literally have this is how the budget is made. And this is how the Senate works. This is what these bills mean. Like, this is how it gets passed through House and Senate and whatever. And we have, like, an exercise on, you know, how would we balance the budget if we were from these different sectors. And so it's instructive in terms of just, like, even if you're very aware politically of what happens, sometimes the actual protocol is not very obvious. And so that orientation part helps with that. And they also introduce some elements that are, like, this is how you network. Because that's the other part of our job, is that professional development, networking, and, you know, expanding your horizon, basically, right? That's the whole point of the fellowship.
But there is, and you mentioned this to me before, there's a huge emphasis of professional development with this fellowship.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So the emphasis on professional development is defined by what your needs are, basically. Your needs could be anywhere from, I want to get actual training on doing things like negotiation, project management, international protocol. Or it can be also just maintaining your academic credentials, because that is your professional development. You know, maintaining your ability to be an academic is how your reputation gets carried on, which is how you implement your projects. So that might be something that you need to do also. So I actually go to a lot of these PD workshops that they have where they offer these skills classes, basically. But we also set up a lot of things like seminars and workshops where you can hone these skills with people who are professionals in the field. And the good thing about the AAAS is that at the very least, everybody in D.C. knows what a AAAS fellow is. So if you cold email somebody saying, or your friend introduces you to somebody saying, like, I'm a AAAS fellow, I'm interested in this, I would like to have a coffee with
They're
you.
They're used to hearing that.
They're used to hearing that, and that's part of our job.
Okay.
So they encourage us to at least have one coffee a week with somebody new, or somebody that we were introduced to or whatever, to really expand our horizons and build that network. And the whole point of the fellowship is really to help you build a wider network with more choices. So they want to have STEM folks be in government, but it's really more of a have STEM folks not be in academia. Because all of these skills are more transferable to other industries or other sectors and help you get out of the rut of doing just like an academic CV or like becoming a professor and basically give you more options. Because even if you applied as an academic to an NGO, for instance, that CV looks really different, and what they're looking for is really different. Like, yeah, your CV will work if you're applying for like head scientist position, but not if you're applying for like director or program officer at a certain NGO, because you need skills that are sometimes very different from being an academic. You need skills in budgeting, you need skills in leadership that might not be apparent to most people in management, and so they look for that in your experience, right?
So that's a great way to introduce what skills did you find that came from Graduate Center, your Graduate Center experience, that transferred really well, and what have you picked up since that you think have been really useful?
So some background on that is that when I was a graduate student, I was basically in charge of my own project.
Okay.
I had two advisors. I had one advisor at CUNY and one at the American Museum, and both of them are not an expert on the thing that I study, but they were both independently experts on the different thing that was relevant. So I had my CUNY advisor was Southeast Asia biogeography person, and then my AMNH advisor is a bat person, and I do
so
Southeast Asian bats, so I'm the mix of that. I'm their hybrid child. And because of the fact that they actually are not like experts specifically, they helped me out a lot in terms of introducing me to people that I could talk to and getting me in touch with people who might be helpful and helping me get paperwork done and, you know, applying for grants and whatever. But in terms of taking care of the project, a lot of that fell on me specifically. And that was also just their management style. They're very hands-off, so I led my project by myself. And also my advisor was hired at the same time as I started grad school, so he was new. We didn't really have a postdoc in our lab, so I was in charge as the most senior person because I was the first grad student, PhD student. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they basically trusted me to do my work. So I went off and I had to apply for my own grants. I had to figure out my own scheduling often. We do, you know, make sure that we go to the field at the same time and we try to make sure our schedules work. But for the most part, I was fairly independent. So whenever we had money come in, it's like, yes, he's in charge of figuring out where we're going sometimes. And like, he's the one who's administering the money through the research foundation at CUNY, but where we're going, I'm basically the one who has to make sure we're spending money that makes sense in a way that makes sense. And when we go off into the field, we split up and they go catch butterflies and I go catch bats. And so I'm in charge of my receipts. I have to do all of my accounting myself. A lot of the grants that I got externally, I also do all my own accounting and reporting. So I'm used to writing stuff like that because I had to. So those skills are obviously really useful because you do have to do a lot of reporting for your projects if you're a program manager or program officer. And that kind of ability to delegate to people is really important too because you do find yourself overworked a lot, especially because my particular program has a lot of components to it. It's not singular to one place, it's regional, and we are actually working with more than four of those countries at the same time. And we have partners over here also. And our partners have partners over there. So it crosses back over. So there's a lot of juggling. And given the current environment, I think a lot of us are also trying to be good citizens in our free time. So there's a lot of energy spent on that as well. But I think that being able to be organized is a skill that really came through and helped with this. Because when I was a grad student, I was very meticulous in terms of like keeping my citation library and in making sure I have an RSS feed with all of my journals I have to read and stuff. So I was very efficient, and it kind of carries over into when you do a government job because you have a lot of things that demand immediate attention, but you have to do them on time. So you do find that those skills are transferable. And specific to the AAAS, though, because they're asking for our STEM subject matter expertise, they want us to apply what we know. And in my case, my actual subject matter expertise matches very well with my current job. So I sit on a lot of technical review panels for grants. I've sat on four of them already this year, two for the Department of State and two programs in Fish and Wildlife, which is more than two panels. And I've been able to provide feedback that is not apparent to them because the people who are on the panels don't always work on the ground. So they appreciate up-to-date knowledge about what is going on the ground, who these people are, what is actually working or not, what makes sense realistically, what are security issues that are not apparent in the submission. Just basically anything that's like, you would probably need to know that. And then just also pointing out like scientific flaws and stuff.
And so in your position, you have been able to keep doing your research on the ground, as you say.
Yeah, so I have a really weird I guess I'm not in the regular position that most people are in that I'm not really a postdoc, not really a professor or anything, but I had a lot of students that I mentored when I was a graduate student already, and they are moving into graduate school now. And so they need advice and they need direction still in terms of developing their project, so they're not like totally independent. And that's fine, you know, that's part of their career development. But because of that, I still do collaborate with them, and I have a lot of folks who I also kind of grew up with academically that are now entering positions, and we still have collaboration. So we want to, you know, finish the work still. So I spend a lot of my free time maintaining my research program, and that's not required of everybody, obviously. Some people are purposely taking the fellowship as a way to move away from academia, but to me, it's an asset to my ability to implement my project and for my ability to actually do my job. So I think that my boss understands, and I understand that this is a component that is not only important to me, but is beneficial. And we've already seen benefits come from it. So I, based on just the network that I have in Southeast Asia, so I think that it has paid out. So they're very willing to let me exercise that a little bit more.
So you see that, or you've kind of seen that government work can allow you to continue some academic pursuits, especially in the research that you're willing to...
So that's another thing that's a little weird to my particular agency, is that Fish and Wildlife is a little bit more academic than other places.
Are they? Okay.
So half of us dress in not as formal clothes. We have you know, cubicles that are decorated with wild animals, and a lot of us do outreach work also, and that's just part of the mission in some ways for a lot of people. So yes, there is a program management and implementation side that I do, but I feel like just that agency itself lends itself to more of the things that we're used to as academics. If you're at another department that's stricter, then you have to follow protocol.
And how do you figure out what the culture is like at the different agencies?
Well, when you get there on the first day, everybody dresses like, you know, we have no idea what we're entering into. But you talk to other fellows and you kind of figure out who's more formal than not.
So your fellow network that you have in D.C., which you explained to me is about how big?
It's about 150 people for the executive fellows, and that's first and second years.
So that's your network to find out how these other
agencies. And then you can also talk to alum. You know, there's a lot of alum around, so our network is bigger than that.
Awesome.
And so everybody's on some sort of list, and then people will introduce you to other people that you have to talk to. So eventually you'll meet the relevant fellows, but they will tell you that, oh yeah, I know that this agency's like this, or my friend works for this agency, I can introduce you to him, you can ask them if you like it. So during that interview week, you can also meet with other fellows. So they organize dates for us where we have lunches and like happy hours with them during the interview week, and we get to ask them questions about how they like being a fellow or what it's like working at those offices, and you get a sense of who is more serious and who is not.
And how was your transition from New York City to D.C.? What did you think about that? Because I think a lot of graduates consider like D.C. would be an easier transition from New York City.
So I love New York. I grew up in New York. That's not true for everybody that went to grad school. I know that.
Right.
I love New York because I love being in New York. I love the busyness. I love the opportunity to do stuff at the last minute, random times a day.
The restaurant's closed here at 10:30.
Yeah, I know. And there's no delis open at 5 a.m.
No.
It's nuts. It's nuts. It's nuts. And actually, there are certain parts of town where I cannot find a coffee place open after 8:30. It's crazy.
It's almost like being in the financial district throughout the whole city.
Yes, but that's basically D.C. though.
Yes.
So downtown D.C. is basically being in the financial district the entire time.
So basically.
And there are certain pockets where there's like more hanging out and stuff. So I live in Maryland, you know. So I live in a more diverse neighborhood. It's further out. There are more options for living. It's cheaper.
And how is your commute?
My commute is...
Is it better than your New York commute?
Oh my God, it's better than New York, but people here are surprised I take it. So that's why I think it's funny, because my commute to my office is an hour in the morning.
Okay.
I literally cut across from Maryland to Virginia, and it is an hour. But I feel like the commute here is also difficult, so I don't drive. Everybody here drives.
Okay.
And there's a lot of traffic, and it's the metro is really, really bad. Like, we literally have a website called Is the Metro on Fire? And it's a Twitter also. And the website is just the five colors of the lines, and then there's like a GIF version of it, which is lit on fire if it's on fire. The commute, I feel like, in New York, I don't know, given now with all the subway breakdowns, but when I was in New York, it was significantly better.
Okay.
And D.C. is only currently going through their repairs and maintenance, and I feel like, at least for New York, you have options on how to get to somewhere. But here, if you don't get there by metro and you can't get there by bus, you have to drive. There's no, like, there's no walkability, you know, accessibility to some of these places, especially if your office is in Virginia. So I don't complain about the commute here. I have an hour commute. I can just read. And it is significantly cheaper than New York.
What is this? So you get more space for your money down here, too,
yes,
right?
Yes, you do. Yeah. And so you get all the services. It's not like an additional thing. So it's...
Have you found the people friendlier?
It depends on where you are.
New Yorker, though, people have different opinions on that.
So I think New York is better because I feel like being direct is important. D.C. is actually a very southern city. There's a lot of bless your heart going on. And it's a political city also. So it's a combination of that where it's not the greatest for truthfulness sometimes. Even though I think 96% of D.C. went, you know, liberal Democrat, I do feel like there is a sense of, like, politeness here that doesn't really... It doesn't really translate. It's not really like politeness. It's more of this like southern gentility. But think of DC as New York's more conservative brother. You know, there's a lot of that going on. But I do live in a place in Maryland where you can drive up to Baltimore in about half an hour. So I go to a lot of community theater and like a lot of these art studio kind of stuff. And there are actually people that live in Baltimore and they commute down here for work because of the MART train.
Okay, so what would your advice be for people who feel like they have a very specific thing, right, that they studied for their dissertation and they've been focusing on for years? How do they translate that to a larger agency and convince that agency that they would be valuable there?
So I think it's reminding yourself that as a doctoral candidate, as a doctoral student, you are actually gaining a lot of skills that other people don't have. Like your ability to analyze things, that's actually a skill that we don't think about. We just have it, right? But that's a skill. And so you need to remember that that's valuable to people, especially if you can say, I can take in large amounts of information and interpret it in a way that I can give you a short answer, recommendation, or whatever. And that particular skill is not common necessarily, especially if it's a scientifically specific expertise. So for instance, we've had folks who were like in astrophysics, and they were the ones who helped read all the documentation about space policy, and they helped draft some of the questions that get asked on the Hill when they do, you know, Senate discussions and hearings and stuff like that. And actually one of them chaired a hearing because she was the expert in her office on the thing, and they said it's most appropriate if you go, not one of us. So you can do all kinds of stuff depending on your expertise, but you can contribute just based on your ability to analyze things. That's still very, very important. And as a graduate student, you also have to remember that if they're the best programs try to remind you that you should have a marketable skill, right? And the marketable skill could be something like analyzing data using R, like just simple things like that in a broader sense. Those are not skills that people have. You know, using ArcGIS to make maps, that is not a thing that most people have. And so you need to remember to be able to translate some of the things that you did into a broader, what is it that I'm actually doing? Can I do it for other people? And just remember that your value as a smart individual is already very, 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 very important. Because Congress is run by 24-year-olds. Your value as a person who thinks clearly and does not jump the gun is very important. And it's going to be a different pace, though, because they're going to want this, like, right now, whereas, like, in academia, we sit on stuff.
So that's a big contrast to the academic world.
Yes.
It's more like, I'm going to need this by tomorrow. You have those kinds of deadlines.
Yes, we do have deadlines like that. We do have some where there are, you know, more lag times, but oftentimes you do have things pop up last minute that will come up very quickly. And I actually find that the ability to churn out something of quality in a short period of time is something that graduate students are good at, because you're sitting on your grant due date and you do it at the last minute and you're like, oh man, I have 12 hours to write this.
Something you're well versed in.
You probably have a lot of experience in that, you know, so I think that that's valuable, and you have to remember that you can do that. You can give them this kind of value. So I do think that looking through how people write their resumes and looking at how they let those things come across, given what they did when they were in grad school, is actually really easy if you focus on what your products and your outcomes are and not just necessarily what your responsibilities were. Because if you're telling people that you can produce something, then that matters more than if you can just do it, right? Because there's an output that they can give to somebody that's tangible. And so that's actually something that people forget. And your ability to communicate, if you do a lot of outreach, that is incredibly important. You're talking to a lot of people who are not subject matter experts. You need to be able to simplify really difficult technical you know, verbiage to some easy to digest, you know, TV show level, almost 6-second elevator speech version. You do sometimes only have about 60 seconds to tell somebody about a complicated four-year program that you're managing.
Wow.
And you have to be able to communicate what exactly it is that it does that's important. It's not just, you know, the overview. It has to be like, what, why is it important? Why should you keep funding it? Why should it be allowed to keep going? And why should I invest in it? And so you need to really be able to do that. And I find that the people who are the best at that are not lab scientists necessarily, but people who spent the time to do outreach and do communication work, because then they've thought about it already too. You know, and they have a spiel. They know how to make a spiel. And that is not always true for a lot of people. They have difficulty in doing that. So it's not always the obvious skills. It's a lot of these intangible skills that you gain if you're from kind of, you know, networking.
Yeah.
Networking is also a skill.
Yes.
Being good at networking is actually a skill you have to cultivate. You know, you have to cultivate the ability to know, you know, when to draw out of conversations, how to handle a business card over, how to contact somebody on LinkedIn with a message that's not too invasive. You know, there's a lot of skills that are involved that you may not think about, and it's a very different town because of that.
Can you explain, like, what your day-to-day would be like at your job at the agency?
So my agency is out in Falls Church, and a lot of times what we do is program management, basically. And program management includes things like looking over the budget and rewriting budgets and rewriting financial reports for it, or writing progress reports on projects that we're implementing. But we also have a lot of people come in to talk to us about what they're doing in their programs, and we get to meet a lot of interesting biologists for our office because of that. I've met several directors of different NGOs from different countries, and I've been to those countries but never talked to those NGOs, so it's great that they were there, so I find out what they're doing. And they often defer to us to say, like, what is a good direction for us to go with what we want to do? And so we get to help make some of these decisions and give them direction. We read a lot. There's a lot of reading involved, because you're reading policy briefs, you're reading news from places that are relevant to your coverage area, your regional area expertise. You read a lot of briefings from other agencies also. So if there's a relevant agency that's doing similar work, they'll often CC you on a report. It might be relevant to decisions you're making, and so they will let you know, and you might want to read that as soon as possible so you can give comments. Sometimes they do require feedback before closing business.
What's your writing demands like?
My writing demands, I've written a report for some parks assessments I've done, and they're about like 20 pages with figures.
Okay.
Because we put in like maps, and we put in some photos when we were in the field. The actual writing part's maybe 10, 11 pages. And that was a product of me going out into the field, and we were doing a parks assessment for Indonesian National Parks, and we went and interviewed 20 different groups of people. So it included park staff, NGOs, local communities, other folks who are involved in that work. And then we had to consolidate everything that they did into one report that says, like, these are the recommendations we're giving to improve management of the park. And we had some downtime in the field also, so like, we couldn't do anything else. We just go out and look at birds and frogs and dragonflies. So, you know, we had some of that.
Yeah.
But it was good because I like getting fresh air. I still like going to the field. So.
Yeah.
I'm probably one of the few people that still gets to go to the field, though, because when I was getting interviewed, there was a question from them that said, so, I see that you have a lot of field experience. Are you going to be okay sitting in an office for 12 months? And I said to them, well, I'm at the point in my career where I just also got a lot of data that I can analyze, and I have students, so if it's only for a short period of time, like especially right now, I can happen to do that, it'll be fine. And then it turns out they lied, and I'm going to the field every few weeks, so they're just like, psych, you didn't mean it, so.
That's okay, because it fits with you.
So. Yeah, it fits with what I do already, so it worked out. So the day-to-day often is also planning those trips, coordinating with people on those trips. And then when you come back, it's doing the budgeting for those. It's doing all your, you know, reimbursement work and your expense reports. Yeah, there's a lot of monetary crunching. There's a lot of evaluation and assessment also of programs and policies that you might have oversight on. There's a lot of things that require your comments as a technical expert, so that's why.
What's it like to comment on, like, you get a policy brief from somebody you don't know, who might be really well respected, right, or an NGO that's really big, and you're asked to comment. How do you approach that, and what do your comments look like?
You comment politely, but fairly and objectively. I give pretty direct comments. So we're still the donor agency. I don't think any NGOs really try to one-up us in any way, honestly. We give comments, we're fair. We work very closely. Fish and Wildlife is unique in that way, in that a lot of the NGOs we work with, we have long-standing relationships with them. So we have what's called a cooperative agreement. So we don't always just grant the money, but we actually have what's called substantial involvement in the actual project. And that means that Fish and Wildlife agrees with the NGO on the terms of what we can contribute to, which includes things like, I don't know, if you're making a workshop selection of participation, and if you're doing work with an NGO that involves picking sites to do the work on, you can have input also. Or if you're doing analyses that an NGO is helping you do, you can help dictate some of the questions, right? So we have things like cooperative agreements where we can help direct what the project is. And other agencies don't really do that. But it actually means that our program officers, they don't sit on some of these review panels, is what they do is they're helping the potential grantees with some of their proposals. So there's a different relationship.
It's more of a team.
It's a team kind of building.
It's not a you submit to me and I say yes or no.
Yes. And so sometimes that happens. And that type of relationship helps us build longer partnerships, which is what you need on the ground a lot, because you need to build trust with other governments and you can't have these one-off projects. So we're very good at that, and people know us because we have had a high profile. And so maintaining those relationships is also a big part of what my branch does. And so when we're commenting on grants or reports or any other reviews, you know, they send it to everybody that's relevant before it becomes an official wire report, and you can comment on it and report those out to non-USG. And they'll just say, okay, you know, I approve of this or I don't approve of this, like, please change this. And people are pretty receptive to change if they know you're supposed to be the expert. And you can negotiate how exactly to phrase it so that it's polite or it gets to the point of what you want it to do. And I think in general, people are pretty much deferential in some ways to the scientists. Because there are some things in my particular office and or in like conservation where it is very much like, you probably know more than us. So as a subject matter expert, not really just as a Fish and Wildlife employee or contractor, they will want to know, you know, what is it that you really think about this so we can make the best decision. And, you know, you tell them, you know, these are my concerns, or like, these are the things they could change to make it better.
So these types of agencies really allow you to be still a subject matter expert in your field without being in academia.
Right.
Which is kind of rare. That seems like a unique place.
Yeah. So my particular placement worked out very well. It's not true for everybody. Some people, they do get placed in offices where it's a little farther afield. And they do have to read up on stuff before they make decisions. But there are also people that are actually in offices that are specifically for broadening participation in STEM fields. And so there are scientists that will be working with programs where they're trying to improve that diversity and equity and inclusion element of the agencies or of science in general. And there's actually a lot of folks who join places like NSF for that, because NSF does a lot of broadening participation work, and they do a lot of programs that are addressing these issues. So there are a mixture of people in terms of the science and the broadening participation. They still have to do science, though, because they have to analyze all the data they get from all their programs and help make decisions, because, you know, whatever your data shows is something that is going to be going to your boss, and they will decide policy based on that, right? So those skills, again, transferable skills, it doesn't really matter if you're a scientist in that way sometimes, you just need those skills. So we actually have social scientists in our mix. They're rare, and so they have their own affinity group. And so they have a couple of them that do like population studies, and they have the same skills basically for their office, because they're analyzing how populations deal with X, Y, and Z policy, what their reaction is, whatever. Then those skills are directly transferable. But sometimes you have, you know, like a biology person do that, and it's like, okay, I can do the analysis, I can figure this out. So mine is unique in that I happen to work out really well for mine. I had a good match. I know some of the other folks in my office also had a really good match. Really, just some of us were really lucky to fit into the expertise that we have already, so we can contribute in ways that others might not be able to. And our office is receptive to us doing that. You know, they are very, I feel like everybody in my office is very open, and, you know, you can go talk to anybody and say, like, hey, can I, like, chat with you for, like, an hour? About how you got to where you are, or what you do, or what kinds of skills you need to be in a similar position. And we have a lot of folks come in from other places to give talks, like brown bags and seminars internally, that we get an opportunity to meet, and it's an opportunity for us to network with them. So they might be an ecologist working for a consulting firm, and you might be interested in consulting, and so you want to talk to them. How do I do that? How do I become a consultant or become an independent contractor? or like maybe it's something that you might want to collaborate with them after you're done with your fellowship, then yeah, okay, you know, this is a good opportunity for me to also talk to you about that and just really tell people, like, this is who I am, this is what I do, and you can call me and come and bother me, like, later also or now about whatever you need. And people are super cool about it. So you can find new people, and even the same places you were working before that you just never knew about.
And so, in general, do you recommend federal government job placement?
So, yes.
What's your impression of it so far?
Yes and no, because it depends on where you get placed, and it also depends on what you're expecting from it. In terms of placement, agencies are very different, and so the personality fit with the office culture is not always a match, right? And so you have to adjust to that, to your own personality, and only you know yourself.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's interesting because within D.C., at the very least, basically the people that work in STEM fields in D.C. offices are probably the smartest people. And it's, okay, so like government often gets the review of like, okay, all the people who like burned out ended up in government. That's not really true for the ones in D.C. It's basically some of the smartest people that you have, and they just wanted a steady job, which is not unreasonable. And they are very bright. And they work very hard, and they are also really awesome mentors sometimes, because they might have been doing this for 5-10 years. And obviously you have federal employees where, like, they're federal employees and you can't get rid of them. So there is a mix, but
gotcha.
But
yeah.
You do have these, you know, extremely nice people also here, so it's nice working with them. We get sent to the field sometimes together. It's awesome. So we just hang out together for, like, 11 days doing our job.
Collecting butterflies.
Yeah, well, it was assessing rhinos and parks and stuff like
awesome.
That. So there are, I feel like, a little bit of a give and take. You know, if you like constantly being challenged and you have a little bit of patience for that kind of thing, then yeah, sure, like federal government could work out for you. I think this particular time is obviously not great because a lot of us are really stressed out. But at the same time, I feel like there is somewhat of a responsibility on the part of career employees to try to make sure that things don't get burned to the ground. And some of us...
I feel more comfortable knowing that you guys are there and you respect the other scientists that you work with.
Yes, and I think it's really important because we're probably some of the only people trying to make sure the wheels are still going. Like, we don't have leadership in place, but we're still trying to do what we can. And sometimes those decisions are not going to get made, but we're still trying to keep everything going. Because if we don't, then everything's going to just fall apart very quickly.
Yeah, how do you maintain your work hours and also protest at the same time?
It's kind of difficult. So
like two full-time jobs.
Yeah, so it's kind of difficult because you do... So fortunately, some of the protests are at 5 o'clock.
Okay,
people start them at 5 o'clock. Okay, it's good. So we will end at maybe about 4:30. It takes me about half an hour to get into the city for 5 o'clock protest. So... I am off the clock by the time I get in town. I am a, you know, private citizen. I'm not an employee or a contractor or whatever. And that's on my time, you know. I do what I want on my time. And, you know, there are rules in place to protect people who are federal employees with their private opinions. And there are actually a lot of, like, secret town halls that were held around D.C. There were, like, secret Facebook groups that were, like, how to, you know, do that as a government employee. And there were people from... you know, Department of Labor that were like, these are the rules, this is what you can and cannot do, this is what you can do to protect yourself. So there were several in my area of town because
we
have a lot of federal employees.
Live well.
There's a lot of us. Most of this city is kind of like that, actually. So
that's what I would assume.
So you have to just make sure you know what the rules are. And actually that comes through also in how you write your policy briefs. Because if you actually read a lot of briefs very carefully, none of the environmental agencies will say things like, we are conserving this animal. We are managing an animal. It's a neutral term. Yeah, so we're using neutral terms a lot.
Okay.
So language skills are really important.
Nice.
Vocabulary is really important because of that.
That's great.
So you need to know how to actually,
good tip.
You know, talk to people in different ways and still not get misconstrued.
To different audiences.
To different audiences.
Have different priorities than you.
Yeah. There is a nuance to the language that benefits you if you have that nuance.
Right.
And I think that comes through a lot.
So would you advise, like, if you're still in grad school, start writing your own grants. That's good practice.
Yeah, write small grants. Because even if you don't get them, or
the
even practice, like, practice
is
good. And, like, you can actually have them shared amongst other folks in your program. So you kind of learn, like, about what other people are doing, learn about things that you might not have thought about before. It helps you build your network of other graduate students also, so that you have, like, a community of people you can rely on. And I think just as an exercise, like, it's a good way to help with that, like, kind of like a bonding exercise with your other cohort mates. I do think that grant writing is very time consuming, but it also sometimes helps clarify what your ideas are, because it makes you have to write on paper what exactly it is that you're trying to get at. And then you can also use parts of it for your dissertation. So it helps you prepare for your end game. So I do think people should be doing that. So yeah, writing is really important, and you definitely get those skills with the program that I was in. I think in the humanities and the social sciences more common also, but it might be a mixed bag in other fields.
Yeah, across the alumni I've talked to, they're saying write. Like, write as much as you can, as often as you can, in different ways for different audiences. Like, really flex those writing muscles.
Yeah. It's definitely a skill that is very, very necessary. And I guess for some people who are, like, more willing to do outreach and communicate, it's not just writing briefs or writing reports, but it's also figuring out how to write tweets and stuff like that, like communicating in shorter bursts, the same information. But I think the different range of skills that you can get, they're all useful in different ways, and maybe you'll specialize in one of them over the other, but they are all valuable skills to have if you really want to be doing something really different, because you might find yourself in a position where you say, well, I don't really know what I want to do, but these skills are useful to other people. So be open to that. There are a lot of workshops, I guess, that are more for how to communicate with broader audiences.
We have a lot of those.
Okay. Like, Alan Alda had one that he was doing at Stony Brook for some time, and now I think it's like a wider science communication workshop that started from Alan Alda doing this thing.
Okay.
But now a lot of people have, like, conferences that work on that also, and people really try to focus on how to message properly. So that's really helpful if you're not very good at it, basically. Because they do, like, improv acting exercises almost, because you have to figure out how to think on your feet.
We had a workshop last spring called Improv for Academics. And it was same vein.
Yeah,
that's supposed to make you better at communicating.
That's very useful. Because you also have to... One of the rules in improv is that whole, like, don't say no, you have to say yes thing. But you kind of have to remember when you talk to the public, it's kind of like that. Because you can't just, like, shoot them down and, like, slap back. You have to gently correct them, you know. Same skill set. Gently correct them if they're wrong about something scientifically. And, like, reason for your argument. And I think that might not be very apparent to academics, as you're used to just saying, like, this is my point. That's not very natural to us sometimes. You might be a debate team captain. You don't want to think about that. So I do think that is something that people forget, and it's definitely very useful. So going back to it, it's really just, yes, you have to go back and learn this if you don't know how to do it, or spend at least a little bit of energy thinking about it. And, you know, there's a lot of folks who, they have no other way of being represented in the media because of a lot of biases, and so Twitter is a better platform for them because it's freer for them to talk about stuff. I mean, there's a lot of trolling and, like, a lot of other BS from Twitter that's, like, harassment, but at the same time, there is some level of freedom that you might not have institutionally, and there's a wider platform still. So there's a give and a take that you can do. So I do think that there's value to it. And as a scientist, you know, it can help you in the future in ways that you never know. So I got asked to be doing a little bit part on a TV show from it. So,
oh, yeah?
Like, yeah, to talk about bats for like 2.5 minutes. And it was really random.
That's
great. So it's one of these things where, like, you can get opportunities out of it just from making yourself more publicly available.
As an expert in that thing.
As an expert in that thing, yeah. And then people will, you know, want to know more about how you got there, you know, especially as a young woman who is not white and who is an immigrant. So coming,
you've got all the
intersections. I got all the things that some people don't like in this town. So it's interesting coming from that perspective. So we do try to make sure that our voices are heard, and I do think that's really important for us because, you know, sometimes you don't have representation. Sometimes you do have to be the one to tell people, like, hey, you know, don't do that. And some people don't realize that even they're trying to be helpful. So it's a rather important skill to have.
Yes.
How to tactfully correct somebody.
So, did you have anything else you wanted to add? Any advice?
So, I feel like one thing that comes up a lot is that PhD students don't realize their value on the job market, like monetary value. I'm not talking about value from the skills. Because we always hear about, like, negotiation and how you negotiate salaries as a professor. When you're on the real job market, you're worth more than that. That's just the bottom line. You know, if you have the intellect that you do, and you can do these things like in terms of analyses and interpretations, you're worth a lot of money on the market. And so you need to know how to sell yourself properly in your resume for a regular job market, but also in understanding that you are worth that. That is difficult for most people who are used to being paid under minimum wage. And recognizing that value, I have found, is actually more difficult for PhDs because they're so used to being underpaid. And oftentimes, you know, the excuse is, like, you know, you're passionate about your job, so, like, that's the only value you need.
You feel lucky to do what you love.
Yes, and you can ask anybody, like, they will tell you that I love doing research, and I love bats. I have a giant bat tattoo on my back. Like, I love bats, you know, but at the same time, like, I also am, basically, I'm in the U.S. by myself. Like, I have to pay for everything myself. I have to depend on myself, and so I'm not going to just accept, like, any salary because I need a job. You know, I will make sure I advocate for myself. I will make sure that I am getting paid a fair wage for what I'm doing. And
do you think it's important to access your network in that sense to find out what you're worth, or how do you go about doing that?
So it's a combination of things. One is talking to your network about what the median range of your salary should be, but also talking to other people who are, you know, in similar positions as you, you know, that are willing to be mentors to you, or like they used to serve in those positions, right? Because they can actually tell you things that you may not know. Like, I randomly networked with somebody by agreeing to go on a hike with another friend of mine, and she was like, oh yeah, these are these like older women who kind of mentor me. They've been through like the field before, they've worked for all these NGOs, and they know more about how to navigate that. And so talking to them and just basically trying to figure out if I'm, like, valuable to them. Like, I told them, well, I don't know what I'm going to do after this. This is very early on in the fellowship. I was like, I don't know what to do after this. You know, if this doesn't work out, maybe I'll just work for an NGO, I guess. And then I told her what I did, and she's like, oh, yeah, every NGO is going to be trying to hire you because nobody works in Southeast Asia. Like, nobody knows Southeast Asia on the ground in that way.
So they had a better feel for what the market needs
exactly.
right now.
Exactly. And so they were like, you're basically worth a lot more than you think, and so you should leverage that because you need to figure out what that is. So you start talking to people, you figure that out. And just knowing, like, as base salary, you know, in different areas, what that's worth. Like, if you are a person that wants to use their data analysis skills, you know, data science was a really big thing that was starting to come out a few years ago. And in some places, they still really need data scientists. And so being able to take those skills into a job market and showing people how you can contribute to them, you know, that has to be coming from your CV. What value do you contribute to them? Then they will give you the monetary value that is for that particular skill also. And so just figuring out what those things are is part of the first step in making your CV or your resume for a regular job market. But recognizing that that's worth actual money, that's step zero. And academics have a really hard time with that. I think there's been a couple of articles that people have started writing about, like, passion is not a good excuse for underpaying
your
STEM people.
Don't take less pay just because you're passionate.
Right, and like, and passion is basically the way that they've excused giving us less money for a very long time. Like, it's the way that people have got the Ponzi scheme to keep going for a long time. You know, it's always been a way to figure out how to pay your PhDs less money by saying you're getting to do something you like to do, so appreciate it. That's not the case. You need to get paid the money that's worth what you're worth. And you should not be afraid to negotiate because of that.
That's great. I love that advice.
Yeah. And on top of that, actually, obviously people have biases about what gender and what race you are and how they will affect your starter wage. But I think that if you're able to communicate your concerns in a way where it's, you know, politically correct, then usually you can at least negotiate something that's worth your while without getting, like, slapped back. And plus, if they really discriminate against you, you probably don't want to work there anyway.
So, yeah.
I do think that that particular skill is not discussed enough, except for more recently. And I do think there is a bigger move for academics when they move away from the job market, the academic market into the job market. They just think of, how can I even get any job? And they forget you actually get paid more also.
And there's options.
Yes.
Well, if that's everything, we can wrap it up. And yep. I want to really thank you for meeting me in D.C. while I was here.
Yeah, no problem.
And, thanks so much.
Yeah, I know. Hopefully you guys get a lot out of it.
Thank you to Susan for all her time and telling us about her fellowship and work at Fish and Wildlife. If you want to hear more stories from our graduates, subscribe to Alumni Aloud on iTunes or where you stream your podcasts. To hear from graduates in person and get more career advice, you can attend one of our alumni panels or participate in one of our upcoming events. Find more information on our website at cuny.is/careerplan or follow us on Twitter at CareerPlanGC. We hope to see you there, and thanks for listening.